In morning, the horse chestnut trees in the Luxembourg Gardens were in bloom. There was the pleasant early morning feeling of a hot day. I read the papers with the coffee and then smoked a cigarette. The flower women were coming up from the market and arranging their daily stock. Students went by, going up to the law school or down to the Sorbonne. The boulevard was busy with trams and people going to work. I got on an S-bus and rode down to the Madeleine, standing on the back platform. From the Madeleine I walked along the Boulevard des Capucines to the Opéra and up to my office. I passed the man with the jumping frogs and the man with the boxer toys. I stepped aside to avoid walking into the thread with which his girl assistant manipulated the boxers. She was standing looking away, the thread in her folded hands. The man was urging two tourists to buy. Three more tourists had stopped and were watching. I walked on, behind a man who was pushing a roller that printed the name Cinzano on the sidewalk in damp letters. All along, people were going to work. It felt pleasant to be going to work. I walked across the avenue and turned into my office. Upstairs in the office, I read the French morning papers, smoked, and then sat at the typewriter and got off a good morning's work. At 11 o'clock, I went over to the Quai d'Orsay in a taxi and went in and sat with about a dozen correspondents while the Foreign Office mouthpiece, a young Nouvelle Revue Française diplomat in horn-rimmed spectacles, talked and answered questions for half an hour. The president of the council was in Lyon making a speech, or rather he was on his way back. Several people asked questions to hear themselves talk, and there were a couple of questions asked by news servicemen who wanted to know the answers. There was no news. I shared a taxi back from the Quai d'Orsay with Woolsey and Crum. "What do you do nights, Jake?" asked Crum. "I never see you around." "Oh, I'm over in the quarter." "I'm coming over some night. The Dingo. That's the great place, isn't it?"
"Yes, that, or this new dive, the Select."
"I've meant to get over," said Crum. "You know how it is, though, with a wife and kids." "Playing any tennis?" Woolsey asked. "Well, no," said Crum. "I can't say I played any this year. I've tried to get away, but Sundays it's always rained, and the courts are so damn crowded."
"The Englishmen all have Saturday off," Woolsey said. "Lucky beggars," said Crum. "Well, I'll tell you. Someday I'm not going to be working for an agency, then I'll have plenty of time to get out in the country."
"That's the thing to do, live out in the country and have a little car."
"I've been thinking some about getting a car next year." I banged on the glass. The chauffeur stopped. "Here's my street," I said. "Come in and have a drink."
"Thanks, old man," Crum said. Woolsey shook his head. "I've got to file that line he got off this morning." I put a 2-franc piece in Crum's hand. "You're crazy, Jake," he said. "This is on me."
"It's all on the office, anyway."
"Nope. I want to get it." I waved goodbye. Crum put his head out.
"See you at lunch on Wednesday."
"You bet." I went to the office in the elevator. Robert Cohn was waiting for me.
"Hello, Jake," he said. "Going out to lunch?"
"Yes. Let me see if there's anything new."
"Where will we eat?"
"Anywhere. I was looking over my desk. Where do you want to eat?"
"How about Wetzel's? They've got good hors d'oeuvres." In the restaurant, we ordered hors d'oeuvres and beer.
The sommelier brought the beer, tall, beaded on the outside of the steins and cold. There were a dozen different dishes of hors d'oeuvres.
"Have any fun last night?" I asked.
"No, I don't think so."
"How's the writing going?"
"Rotten. I can't get this second book going."
"That happens to everybody."
"I'm sure of that. It gets me worried, though."
"Thought any more about going to South America?"
"I mean that."
"Well, why don't you start off?"
"Francis."
"Well, I said take her with you."
"She wouldn't like it. That isn't the sort of thing she likes. She likes a lot of people around."
"Tell her to go to hell."
"I can't. I've got certain obligations to her."
He shoved the sliced cucumbers away and took a pickled herring.
"What do you know about Lady Brett Ashley, Jake?"
"Her name's Lady Ashley. Brett's her own name. She's a nice girl." I said. She's getting a divorce, and she's going to marry Mike Campbell. He's over in Scotland now. Why?
She's a remarkably attractive woman.
Isn't she?
There's a certain quality about her, a certain fineness. She seems to be absolutely fine. And straight. She's very nice. I don't know how to describe the quality, Cohen said. I suppose it's breeding.
You sound as though you liked her pretty well.
I do.
I shouldn't wonder if I were in love with her. She's a drunk, I said. She's in love with Mike Campbell, and she's going to marry him. He's going to be rich as hell someday.
I don't believe she'll ever marry him.
Why not?
I don't know. I just don't believe it.
Have you known her a long time?
Yes, I said. She was a VAD in a hospital I was in during the war.
She must have been just a kid then. She's 34 now.
When did she marry Ashley?
During the war. Her own true love had just kicked off with a dysentery.
You talk sort of bitter.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. I was just trying to give you the facts.
I don't believe she would marry anybody she didn't love.
Well, I said she's done it twice.
I don't believe it.
Well, I said, don't ask me a lot of fool questions if you don't like the answers.
I didn't ask you that.
You asked me what I knew about Brett Ashley.
I didn't ask you to insult her.
Oh, go to hell.
He stood up from the table, his face white, and stood there, white and angry behind the little plates of hors d'oeuvres. Sit down, I said. Don't be a fool.
You've got to take that back.
Oh, cut out the prep school stuff.
Take it back.
Sure, anything. I never heard of Brett Ashley. How's that?
No, not that. About me going to hell.
Oh, don't go to hell, I said. Stick around. We're just starting lunch.
Cohen smiled again and sat down. He seemed glad to sit down.
What the hell would he have done if he hadn't sat down? You say such damned insulting things, Jake.
I'm sorry. I've got a nasty tongue. I never mean it when I say nasty things.
I know it, Cohen said. You're really about the best friend I have, Jake.
God help you, I thought.
Forget what I said out loud. I'm sorry.
It's all right. It's fine. I was just sore for a minute. Good. Let's get something else to eat.
After we finished the lunch, we walked up to the Café de la Paix and had coffee. I could feel Cohen wanted to bring up Brett again, but I held him off it. We talked about one thing and another, and I left him to come to the office. Chapter 6. At 5 o'clock, I was in the Hotel Crillon waiting for Brett. She was not there, so I sat down and wrote some letters. They were not very good letters, but I hoped their being on Crillon stationery would help them. Brett did not turn up, so about 5:45 I went down to the bar and had a Jack Rose with George, the barman. Brett had not been in the bar either, and so I looked for her upstairs on my way out and took a taxi to the Café Select. Crossing the Seine, I saw a string of barges being towed empty down the current, riding high, the bargemen at the sweeps as they came toward the bridge. The river looked nice. It was always pleasant crossing bridges in Paris. The taxi rounded the statue of the inventor of the semaphore, engaged in doing same, and turned up the Boulevard Raspail, and I sat back to let that part of the ride pass. The Boulevard Raspail always made dull riding. It was like a certain stretch on the PLM between Fontainebleau and Montereau that always made me feel bored and dead and dull until it was over. I suppose it is some association of ideas that makes those dead places in a journey. There are other streets in Paris as ugly as the Boulevard Raspail. It is a street I do not mind walking down at all, but I cannot stand to ride along it. Perhaps I had read something about it once. That was the way Robert Cohen was about all of Paris. I wondered where Cohen got that incapacity to enjoy Paris.
Possibly from Mencken? Mencken hates Paris, I believe. So many young men get their likes and dislikes from Mencken. The taxi stopped in front of the Rotonde. No matter what café in Montparnasse you ask a taxi driver to bring you to from the right bank of the river, they always take you to the Rotonde. 10 years from now, it will probably be the Dome. It was near enough anyway. I walked past the sad tables of the Rotonde to the Select. There were a few people inside at the bar, and outside, alone, sat Harvey Stone. He had a pile of saucers in front of him, and he needed a shave. "Sit down," said Harvey. "I've been looking for you." "What's the matter?" "Nothing, just looking for you."
"Been out to the races?"
"No, not since Sunday."
"What do you hear from the States?"
"Nothing. Absolutely nothing."
"What's the matter?"
"I don't know. I'm through with them. I'm absolutely through with them."
He leaned forward and looked me in the eye.
"Do you want to know something, Jake?"
"Yes."
"I haven't had anything to eat for 5 days."
I figured rapidly back in my mind it was 3 days ago that Harvey had won 200 francs from me shaking poker dice in the New York bar.
"What's the matter?"
"No money. Money hasn't come." He paused.
"I tell you, it's strange, Jake. When I'm like this, I just want to be alone. I want to stay in my own room. I'm like a cat."
I felt in my pocket.
"Would 100 help you any, Harvey?"
"Yes."
"Come on, let's go and eat."
"There's no hurry. Have a drink."
"Better eat."
"No, when I get like this, I don't care whether I eat or not."
We had a drink. Harvey added my saucer to his own pile. "Do you know Mencken, Harvey?"
"Yes, why?"
"What's he like?"
"He's all right. He says some pretty funny things. Last time I had dinner with him, we talked about Hoffenheimer. The trouble is, he said, he's a garter snapper."
"That's not bad."
"That's not bad."
"He's through now," Harvey went on. "He's written about all the things he knows, and now he's on all the things he doesn't know."
"I guess he's all right," I said. "I just can't read him."
"Oh, nobody reads him now," Harvey said, "except the people that used to read the Alexander Hamilton Institute."
"Well," I said, "that was a good thing, too."
"Sure," said Harvey.
So we sat and thought deeply for a while.
"Have another port?"
"All right," said Harvey.
"There comes Cone," I said.
Robert Cone was crossing the street.
"That moron," said Harvey.
Cone came up to our table.
"Hello, you bums," he said.
"Hello, Robert," Harvey said. "I was just telling Jake here that you're a moron."
"What do you mean?"
"Tell us right off. Don't think. What would you rather do if you could do anything you wanted?"
Cone started to consider.
"Don't think. Bring it right out."
"I don't know," Cone said. "What's it all about anyway?"
"I mean, what would you rather do? What comes into your head first, no matter how silly it is?"
"I don't know," Cone said. "I think I'd rather play football again with what I know about handling myself now."
"I misjudged you," Harvey said. "You're not a moron. You're only a case of arrested development."
"You're awfully funny, Harvey," Cone said. "Someday somebody will push your face in."
Harvey Stone laughed.
"You think so?"
"They won't, though, because it wouldn't make any difference to me. I'm not a fighter."
"It would make a difference to you if anybody did it."
"No, it wouldn't. That's where you make your big mistake, because you're not intelligent."
"Cut it out about me."
"Sure," said Harvey. "Doesn't make any difference to me. You don't mean anything to me."
"Come on, Harvey," I said. "Have another Porto."
"No," he said. "I'm going up the street and eat. See you later, Jake."
He walked out and up the street. I watched him crossing the street, through the taxi, small, heavy, slowly sure of himself in the traffic.
"He always gets me sore," Cohn said. "I can't stand him."
"I like him," I said. "I'm fond of him."
"You don't want to get sore at him."
"I know it," Cohn said. "He just gets on my nerves."
"Right this afternoon?"
"No, I couldn't get it going. It's harder to do than my first book. I'm having a hard time handling it."
The sort of healthy conceit that he had when he returned from America early in the spring was gone. Then he had been sure of his work, only with these personal longings for adventure. Now the sureness was gone. Somehow I feel I have not shown Robert Cohn clearly. The reason is that until he fell in love with Brett, I never heard him make one remark that would in any way detach him from other people. He was nice to watch on the tennis court. He had a good body, and he kept it in shape. He handled his cards well at bridge, and he had a funny sort of undergraduate quality about him. If he were in a crowd, nothing he said stood out. He wore what used to be called polo shirts at school, and may be called that still, but he was not professionally youthful. I do not believe he thought about his clothes much. Externally, he had been formed at Princeton. Internally, he had been molded by the two women who had trained him. He had a nice, boyish sort of cheerfulness that had never been trained out of him, and I probably have not brought it out. He loved to win at tennis. He probably loved to win as much as Lundlund, for instance. On the other hand, he was not angry at being beaten. When he fell in love with Brett, his tennis game went all to pieces. People beat him who had never had a chance with him. He was very nice about it. Anyway, we were sitting on the terrace of the Café Select, and Harvey Stone had just crossed the street. "Come on up to the Lila," I said.
"I have a date."
"What time?"
"Francis is coming here at 7:15.
"There she is." Frances Klein was coming toward us from across the street. She was a very tall girl who walked with a great deal of movement. She waved and smiled. We watched her cross the street.
"Hello," she said. "I'm so glad you're here, Jake. I've been wanting to talk to you."
"Hello, Francis," said Cohn. He smiled.
"Why, hello, Robert. Are you here?"
She went on, talking rapidly. "I've had the darndest time. This one," shaking her head at Cohn, "didn't come home for lunch."
I wasn't supposed to."
"Oh, I know, but you didn't say anything about it to the cook. Then I had a date myself, and Paula wasn't at her office. I went to the Ritz and waited for her, and she never came, and of course I didn't have enough money to lunch at the Ritz."
"What did you do?"
"Oh, went out, of course." She spoke in a sort of imitation joyful manner. "I always keep my appointments. No one keeps theirs nowadays. I ought to know better. How are you, Jake, anyway?"
"Fine."
"That was a fine girl you had at the dance and then went off with that Brett one."
"Don't you like her?" Cohn asked.
"I think she's perfectly charming, don't you?"
Cohn said nothing.
"Look, Jake, I want to talk with you. Would you come over with me to the Dome? You'll stay here, won't you, Robert? Come on, Jake."
We crossed the Boulevard Montparnasse and sat down at a table. A boy came up with the Paris Times, and I bought one and opened it.
"What's the matter, Francis?"
"Oh, nothing," she said, "except that he wants to leave me."
"How do you mean?"
"Oh, he told everyone that we were going to be married. And I told my mother and everyone, and now he doesn't want to do it."
"What's the matter?"
"He's decided he hasn't lived enough. I knew it would happen when he went to New York." She looked up very bright-eyed and trying to talk inconsequentially.
"I wouldn't marry him if he doesn't want to. Of course I wouldn't. I wouldn't marry him now for anything, but it does seem to me to be a little late now, after we've waited 3 years and I've just gotten my divorce."
I said nothing. "We were going to celebrate so... and instead we've just had scenes. It's so childish. We have dreadful scenes, and he cries and begs me to be reasonable, but he says he just can't do it."
It's rotten luck. I should say it is rotten luck. I've wasted 2 years and a half on him now, and I don't know now if any man will ever want to marry me. 2 years ago, I could have married anybody I wanted down at Con, all the old ones that wanted to marry somebody chic and settle down were crazy about me. Now I don't think I could get anybody. Sure, you could marry anybody. No, I don't believe it. And I'm fond of him, too. And I'd like to have children. I always thought we'd have children. She looked at me very brightly. I never liked children much, but I don't want to think I'll never have them. I always thought I'd have them and then like them. He's got children. Oh, yes, he's got children, and he's got money, and he's got a rich mother, and he's written a book. And nobody will publish my stuff, nobody at all. It isn't bad, either, and I haven't got any money at all. I could have had alimony, but I got the divorce the quickest way. She looked at me again very brightly. It isn't right. It's my own fault, and it's not, too. I ought to have known better, and when I tell him, he just cries and says he can't marry. Why can't he marry? I'd be a good wife. I'm easy to get along with. I leave him alone. It doesn't do any good. It's a rotten shame. Yes, it is a rotten shame. But there's no use talking about it, is there? Come on, let's go back to the cafe. And of course there isn't anything I can do. No. Just don't let him know I talked to you. I know what he wants. Now, for the first time, she dropped her bright, terribly cheerful manner. He wants to go back to New York alone and be there when his book comes out, so when a lot of little chickens like it. That's what he wants. Maybe they won't like it. I don't think he's that way, really. You don't know him like I do, Jake. That's what he wants to do. I know it, I know it. That's why he doesn't want to marry. He wants to have a big triumph this fall all by himself. Want to go back to the cafe? Yes, come on. We got up from the table, they had never brought us a drink, and started across the street toward the Select, where Cone sat smiling at us from behind the marble-top table. Well, what are you smiling at? Francis asked him. Feel pretty happy? I was smiling at you and Jake with your secrets. Oh, what I've told Jake isn't any secret. Everybody will know it soon enough. I only wanted to give Jake a decent version. What was it about your going to England? Yes, about my going to England. Oh, Jake, I forgot to tell you I'm going to England. Isn't that fine? Yes, that's the way it's done in the very best families. Robert's sending me. He's going to give me £200, and then I'm going to visit friends. Won't it be lovely? The friends don't know about it yet. She turned to Cone and smiled at him. He was not smiling now. You were only going to give me £100, weren't you, Robert? But I made him give me £200. He's really very generous, aren't you, Robert? I do not know how people could say such terrible things to Robert Cone. There are people to whom you could not say insulting things. They give you a feeling that the world would be destroyed, would actually be destroyed before your eyes if you said certain things. But here was Cone taking it all. Here it was, all going on right before me, and I did not even feel an impulse to try and stop it. And this was friendly joking to what went on later. How can you say such things, Francis? Cone interrupted. Listen to him. I'm going to England. I'm going to visit friends. Ever visit friends that didn't want you? Oh, they'll have to take me, all right. How do you do, my dear? Such a long time since we've seen you, and how is your dear mother? Yes, how is my dear mother? She put all her money into French war bonds. Yes, she did, probably the only person in the world that did. And what about Robert? Or else very careful talking around Robert. You must be most careful not to mention him, my dear. Poor Francis has had a most unfortunate experience. Won't it be fun, Robert? Don't you think it will be fun, Jake? She turned to me with that terribly bright smile. It was very satisfactory to her to have an audience for this. And where are you going to be, Robert?
It's my own fault, all right. Perfectly my own fault. When I made you get rid of your little secretary on the magazine, I ought to have known you'd get rid of me the same way. Jake doesn't know about that. Should I tell him?
Shut up, Francis, for God's sake.
Yes, I'll tell him. Robert had a little secretary on the magazine, just the sweetest little thing in the world, and he thought she was wonderful. And then I came along, and he thought I was pretty wonderful, too, so I made him get rid of her. And he had brought her to Provincetown from Carmel when he moved the magazine, and he didn't even pay her fare back to the coast, all to please me. He thought I was pretty fine. Then. Didn't you, Robert? You mustn't misunderstand, Jake. It was absolutely platonic with the secretary, not even platonic, nothing at all, really. It was just that she was so nice, and he did that just to please me. Well, I suppose that we that live by the sword shall perish by the sword. Isn't that literary, though? You want to remember that for your next book, Robert. You know Robert is going to get material for a new book. Aren't you, Robert? That's why he's leaving me. He's decided I don't film well. You see, he was so busy all the time that we were living together, writing on this book, that he doesn't remember anything about us. So now he's going out and gets some new material. Well, I hope he gets something frightfully interesting. Listen, Robert, dear, let me tell you something. You won't mind, will you? Don't have scenes with your young ladies. Try not to, because you can't have scenes without crying. And then you pity yourself so much you can't remember what the other person's said. You'll never be able to remember any conversations that way. Just try and be calm. I know it's awfully hard, but remember, it's for literature. We all ought to make sacrifices for literature. Look at me. I'm going to England without a protest, all for literature. We must all help young writers. Don't you think so, Jake? But you're not a young writer, are you, Robert? You're 34. Still, I suppose that is young for a great writer. Look at Hardy. Look at Anatole France. He just died a little while ago. Robert doesn't think he's any good, though some of his French friends told him. He doesn't read French very well himself. He wasn't a good writer like you are, was he, Robert? Do you think he ever had to go and look for material? What do you suppose he said to his mistresses when he wouldn't marry them? I wonder if he cried, too. Oh, I've just thought of something. She put her gloved hand up to her lips. I know the real reason why Robert won't marry me, Jake. It's just come to me. They've sent it to me in a vision in the Café Select. Isn't it mystic? Some day they'll put a tablet up like at Lourdes. Do you want to hear, Robert? I'll tell you. It's so simple. I wonder why I never thought about it. Why, you see, Robert's always wanted to have a mistress, and if he doesn't marry me, why, then he's had one. She was his mistress for over 2 years. See how it is? And if he marries me, like he's always promised he would, that would be the end of all the romance. Don't you think that's bright of me to figure that out? It's true, too. Look at him and see if it's not. Where are you going, Jake?
I've got to go in and see Harvey Stone a minute.
Cone looked up as I went in. His face was white. Why did he sit there? Why did he keep on taking it like that? As I stood against the bar looking out, I could see them through the window. Francis was talking on to him, smiling brightly, looking into his face each time she asked, "Isn't it so, Robert?" Or maybe she did not ask that now. Perhaps she said something else. I told the barman I did not want anything to drink and went out through the side door. As I went out the door, I looked back through the two thicknesses of glass and saw them sitting there. She was still talking to him. I went down a side street to the Boulevard Raspail. A taxi came along, and I got in and gave the driver the address of my flat. Chapter 7. As I started up the stairs, the concierge knocked on the glass of the door of her lodge, and as I stopped, she came out. She had some letters and a telegram.
"Here is the post, and there was a lady here to see you."
"Did she leave a card?"
No, she was with a gentleman. It was the one who was here last night. In the end, I find she's very nice.
Was she with a friend of mine?
I don't know. He was never here before. He was very large, very, very large. She was very nice, very, very nice. Last night she was perhaps a little.
She put her head on one hand and rocked it up and down.
I speak perfectly frankly, Monsieur Barnes. Last night I found her not so gentille. Last night I formed another idea of her, but listen to what I tell you. She is très, très gentille. She is a very good family. It is a thing you can see.
They did not leave any word?
Yes, they said they would be back in an hour.
Send them up when they come?
Yes, Monsieur Barnes, and that lady there is someone. An eccentric, perhaps, but quelqu'un.
The concierge, before she became a concierge, had owned a drink-selling concession at the Paris racecourses. Her life work lay in the pelouse, but she kept an eye on the people of the pesage, and she took great pride in telling me which of my guests were well brought up, which were of good family, who were sportsmen, a French word pronounced with the accent on the men. The only trouble was that people who did not fall into any of those three categories were very liable to be told there was no one home. Shea Barnes. One of my friends, an extremely underfed-looking painter, who was obviously, to Madame Drusinel, neither well brought up, of good family, nor a sportsman, wrote me a letter asking if I could get him a pass to get by the concierge so he could come up and see me occasionally in the evenings. I went up to the flat wondering what Brett had done to the concierge. The wire was a cable from Bill Gorton saying he was arriving on the France. I put the mail on the table, went back to the bedroom undressed, and had a shower. I was rubbing down when I heard the doorbell pull. I put on a bathrobe and slippers and went to the door. It was Brett. Back of her was the Count. He was holding a great bunch of roses.
"Hello, darling," said Brett. "Aren't you going to let us in?"
"Come on, I was just bathing."
"Aren't you the fortunate man bathing?"
"Only a shower. Sit down, Count Mipipopoulos. What will you drink?"
"I don't know whether you like flowers, sir," the Count said, "but I took the liberty of just bringing these roses."
"Here, give them to me." Brett took them. "Get me some water in this, Jake." I filled the big earthenware jug with water in the kitchen, and Brett put the roses in it and placed them in the center of the dining room table.
"I say we have had a day."
"You don't remember anything about a date with me at the Crillon?"
"No. Did we have one? I must have been blind."
"You were quite drunk, my dear," said the Count.
"Wasn't I, though? And the Count's been a brick, absolutely.
You've got hell's own drag with the concierge now."
"I ought to have. Gave her 200 francs.
"Don't be a damn fool."
"His," she said, and nodded at the Count.
"I thought we ought to give her a little something for last night. It was very late."
"He's wonderful," Brett said. "He remembers everything that's happened."
"So do you, my dear."
"Fancy," said Brett. "Who'd want to? I say, Jake, do we get a drink?"
"You get it while I go in and dress. You know where it is.
Brother."
While I dressed, I heard Brett put down glasses and then a siphon and then heard them talking. I dressed slowly, sitting on the bed. I felt tired and pretty rotten. Brett came in the room, a glass in her hand, and sat on the bed.
"What's the matter, darling? Do you feel rocky?"
She kissed me coolly on the forehead.
"Oh, Brett, I love you so much."
"Darling," she said.
"Then, do you want me to send him away?"
"No, he's nice."
"I'll send him away."
"No, don't."
"Yes, I'll send him away."
"You can't just like that."
"Can't I, though? You stay here. He's mad about me, I tell you."
She was gone out of the room. I lay face down on the bed. I was having a bad time.
I heard them talking, but I did not listen. Brett came in and sat on the bed.
Poor old darling.
She stroked my head. What did you say to him? I was lying with my face away from her. I did not want to see her. Send him for champagne. He loves to go for champagne. Then later, do you feel better, darling? Is the head any better?
It's better.
Lie quiet. He's gone to the other side of town. Couldn't we live together, Brett? Couldn't we just live together? I don't think so. I'd just tromp you with everybody. You couldn't stand it.
I stand it now.
That would be different. It's my fault, Jake. It's the way I'm made. Couldn't we go off in the country for a while? It wouldn't be any good.
I'll go if you like, but I couldn't live quietly in the country,
not with my own true love.
I know.
Isn't it rotten? There isn't any use my telling you I love you.
You know I love you.
Let's not talk. Talking's all bilge. I'm going away from you, and then Michael's coming back.
Why are you going away? Better for you, better for me.
When are you going?
Soon as I can.
Where?
San Sebastian.
Can't we go together?
No. That would be a hell of an idea after we just talked it out.
We never agreed.
Oh, you know as well as I do. Don't be obstinate, darling.
Oh, sure, I said. I know you're right. I'm just low, and when I'm low, I talk like a fool. I sat up, leaned over, found my shoes beside the bed, and put them on. I stood up.
Don't look like that, darling.
How do you want me to look?
Oh, don't be a fool. I'm going away tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yes, didn't I say so? I am.
Let's have a drink, then. The Count will be back.
Yes, he should be back. You know, he's extraordinary about buying champagne. It means any amount to him.
We went into the dining room. I took up the brandy bottle and poured Brett a drink and one for myself. There was a ring at the bell pull. I went to the door, and there was the Count. Behind him was the chauffeur carrying a basket of champagne.
"Where should I have him put it, sir?" asked the Count.
"In the kitchen," Brett said.
"Put it in there, Henry," the Count motioned. "Now go down and get the ice."
He stood looking after the basket inside the kitchen door.
"I think you'll find that's a very good wine," he said. "I know we don't get much of a chance to judge good wine in the States now, but I get this from a friend of mine that's in the business."
"Oh, you always have someone in the trade," Brett said.
"This fellow raises grapes. He's got thousands of acres of them."
"What's his name?" asked Brett. "Veuve Clicquot?"
"No,"
said the Count.
"Mums, he's the Baron."
"Isn't it wonderful," said Brett, "we all have titles. Why haven't you a title, Jake?"
"I assure you, sir," the Count put his hand on my arm, "it never does a man any good. Most of the time it costs you money."
"Oh, I don't know. It's damned useful sometimes," Brett said.
"I've never known it to do me any good."
"You haven't used it properly. I've had hell's own amount of credit on mine."
"Do sit down, Count," I said. "Let me take that stick." The Count was looking at Brett across the table under the gaslight. She was smoking a cigarette and flicking the ashes on the rug. She saw me notice it.
"I say, Jake, I don't want to ruin your rugs. Can't you give a chap an ashtray?"
I found some ashtrays and spread them around. The chauffeur came up with a bucket full of salted ice.
"Put two bottles in it, Henry," the Count called. "Anything else, sir?" "No, wait down in the car."
He turned to Brett and to me.
"We'll want to ride out to the Bois. For dinner?"
"If you like," Brett said. "I couldn't eat a thing."
"I always like a good meal," said the Count.
"Should I bring the wine in, sir?" asked the chauffeur.
Yes, bring it in, Henry, said the Count.
He took out a heavy pigskin cigar case and offered it to me.
Like to try a real American cigar.
Thanks, I said, I'll finish the cigarette. He cut off the end of his cigar with a gold cutter he wore on one end of his watch chain.
I like a cigar to really draw, said the Count. Have the cigars you smoke, don't draw.
He lit the cigar, puffed at it, looked across the table at Brett.
And when you're divorced, Lady Ashley, then you won't have a title.
No, what a pity.
No, said the Count, you don't need a title. You've got class all over you.
Thanks, awfully decent of you.
I'm not joking, you. The Count blew a cloud of smoke. You got the most class of anybody I ever seen. You got it. That's all.
Nice of you, said Brett. Mommy would be pleased. Couldn't you write it out, and I'll send it in a letter to her?
I'll tell her, too, said the Count. I'm not joking you. I never joke people. Joke people and you make enemies. That's what I always say.
You're right, Brett said. You're terribly right. I always joke people, and I haven't a friend in the world. Except Jake here.
You don't joke him?
That's it.
Do you now, asked the Count. Do you joke him?
Brett looked at me and wrinkled up the corners of her eyes. No, she said, I wouldn't joke him.
See, said the Count, you don't joke him.
This is a hell of a dull talk, Brett said. How about some of that champagne? The Count reached down and twirled the bottles in the shiny bucket.
It isn't cold yet. You're always drinking, my dear. Why don't you just talk?
I've talked too ready much. I've talked myself all out to Jake.
I should like to hear you really talk, my dear. When you talk to me, you never finish your sentences at all.
Leave them for you to finish. Let anyone finish them as they like.
It is a very interesting system.
The Count reached down and gave the bottles a twirl. Still, I would like to
hear you talk sometime.
Isn't he a fool? Brett asked. Now, the Count brought up a bottle.
I think this is cool.
I brought a towel, and he wiped the bottle dry and held it up.
I like to drink champagne from magnums. The wine is better, but it would have been too hard to cool.
He held the bottle, looking at it. I put out the glasses. I say you might open it, Brett suggested.
Yes, my dear, now I'll open it.
It was amazing champagne.
I say that is wine.
Brett held up her glass.
We ought to toast something. Here's to royalty. This wine is too good for toast drinking, my dear. You don't want to mix emotions up with a wine like that. You'll lose the taste.
Brett's glass was empty. You ought to write a book on wines, Count, I said.
Mr. Barnes, answered the Count, all I want out of wines is to enjoy them.
Let's enjoy a little more of this. Brett pushed her glass forward. The Count poured very carefully.
There, my dear, now you enjoy that slowly, and then you can get drunk.
Drunk? Drunk?
My dear, you are charming when you are drunk.
Listen to the man.
Mr. Barnes, the Count poured my glass full. She is the only lady I have ever known who was as charming when she was drunk as when she was sober.
You haven't been around much, have you?
Yes, my dear, I've been around very much. I've been around a very great deal.
Drink your wine, said Brett. We've all been around. I dare say Jake here has seen as much as you have.
My dear, I am sure Mr. Barnes has seen a lot Don't think I don't think so, sir. I have seen a lot, too.
Of course you have, my dear, Brett said. I was only ragging.
I have been in 7 wars and 4 revolutions, the Count said.
Soldiering? Brett asked.
Sometimes, my dear, and I have got arrow wounds. Have you ever seen arrow wounds?
Let's have a look at them. The Count stood up, unbuttoned his vest, and opened his shirt. He pulled up the undershirt onto his chest and stood, his chest black and big stomach muscles bulging under the light.
You see them?
Below the line where his ribs stopped were 2 raised white welts.
See, on the back, where they come out.
Above the small of the back were the same 2 scars, raised, as thick as a finger.
I say, those are something.
Clean through.
The Count was tucking in his shirt.
Where did you get those, I asked.
In Abyssinia, when I was 21 years old.
What were you doing? Asked Brett. Were you in the army?
I was on a business trip, my dear. I told you he was one of us, didn't I? Brett turned to me. I love you, Count. You're a darling.
You make me very happy, my dear, but it isn't true.
Don't be an ass.
You see, Mr. Barnes, it is because I have lived very much that now I can enjoy everything so well. Don't you find it like that?
Yes, absolutely.
I know, said the Count. That is the secret. You must get to know the values.
Doesn't anything ever happen to your values? Brett asked.
No, not anymore.
Never fall in love?
Always, said the Count. I'm always in love.
What does that do to your values?
That, too, has got a place in my values.
You haven't any values. You're dead. That's all.
No, my dear, you're not right. I'm not dead at all.
We drank 3 bottles of the champagne, and the Count left the basket in my kitchen. We dined at a restaurant in the Bois. It was a good dinner. Food had an excellent place in the Count's values. So did wine. The Count was in fine form during the meal. So was Brett. It was a good party.
Where would you like to go? Asked the Count after dinner.
We were the only people left in the restaurant. The 2 waiters were standing over against the door. They wanted to go home. We might go up on the hill, Brett said. Haven't we had a splendid party? The Count was beaming. He was very happy.
You are very nice people, he said.
He was smoking a cigar again.
Why don't you get married, you two?
We want to lead our own lives, I said. We have our careers, Brett said. Come on, let's get out of this.
Have another brandy, the Count said.
Get it on the hill.
No, have it here where it is quiet.
You and your quiet, said Brett. What is it men feel about quiet?
We like it, said the Count. Like you like noise, my dear.
All right, said Brett. Let's have one.
Sommelier, the Count called.
Yes, sir.
What is the oldest brandy you have?
1811, sir.
Bring us a bottle.
I say, don't be ostentatious. Call him off, Jake.
Listen, my dear, I get more value for my money in old brandy than in any other antiquities.
Got many antiquities?
I got a houseful.
Finally, we went up to Montmartre. Inside Zelly's, it was crowded, smoky, and noisy. The music hit you as you went in. Brett and I danced. It was so crowded we could barely move. The drummer waved at Brett. We were caught in the jam, dancing in one place in front of him.
How are you?
Great.
That's good.
He was all teeth and lips.
He's a great friend of mine, Brett said. Damn good drummer.
The music stopped and we started toward the table where the count sat. Then the music started again and we danced. I looked at the count. He was sitting at the table smoking a cigar. The music stopped again. Let's go over. Brett started toward the table. The music started and again we danced, tight in the crowd.
You are a rotten dancer, Jake. Michael's the best dancer I know.
He's splendid.
He's got his points.
I like him, I said. I'm damned fond of him.
I'm going to marry him, Brett said. Funny, I haven't thought about him for a week.
Don't you write him?
Not I. Never write letters.
I'll bet he writes to you.
Brother, damn good letters, too.
When are you going to get married?
How do I know? As soon as we can get the divorce. Michael's trying to get his mother to put up for it.
Could I help you?
Don't be an ass. Michael's people have loads of money.
The music stopped. We walked over to the table. The count stood up.
Very nice, he said. You looked very, very nice.
Don't you dance, Count, I asked.
No, I'm too old.
Oh, come off it, Brett said.
My dear, I would do it if I would enjoy it. I enjoy to watch you dance.
Splendid, Brett said. I'll dance again for you sometime. I say, what about your little friend Zizi?
Let me tell you, I support that boy, but I don't want to have him around.
He is rather hard.
You know, I think that boy's got a future. But personally, I don't want him around.
Jake's rather the same way.
He gives me the willies.
Well, the Count shrugged his shoulders. About his future, you can't ever tell, anyhow. He's a father, was a great friend of my father.
Come on, let's dance, Brett said.
We danced. It was crowded and close. Oh, darling, Brett said, I'm so miserable. I had that feeling of going through something that has all happened before.
You were happy a minute ago.
The drummer shouted,
You can't do time.
It's all gone. What's the matter? I don't know. I just feel terribly. The drummer chanted, then turned to his sticks.
Wanna go?
I had the feeling as in a nightmare of it all being something repeated, something I had been through and that now I must go through again. The drummer sang softly.
Let's go, said Brett. You don't mind.
The drummer shouted and grinned at Brett.
All right, I said.
We got out from the crowd. Brett went to the dressing room.
Brett wants to go, I said to the count.
He nodded.
Does she? That's fine. You take the car. I'm going to stay here for a while, Mr. Barnes.
We shook hands.
It was a wonderful time, I said. I wish you would let me get this.
I took a note out of my pocket.
Mr. Barnes, don't be ridiculous, the count said.
Brett came over with her wrap on. She kissed the count and put her hand on his shoulder to keep him from standing up. As we went out the door, I looked back and there were three girls at his table. We got into the big car. Brett gave the chauffeur the address of her hotel.
No. Don't come up, she said at the hotel.
She had rung, and the door was unlatched.
Really?
No. Please?
Good night, Brett, I said. I'm sorry you feel rotten.
Good night, Jake.
Good night, darling.
I won't see you again.
We kissed, standing at the door. She pushed me away. We kissed again.
Don't. Brett said.
She turned quickly and went into the hotel. The chauffeur drove me around to my flat. I gave him 20 francs and he touched his cap and said, Good night, sir, and drove off. I rang the bell. The door opened and I went upstairs and went to bed. Book 2, Chapter 8. I did not see Brett again until she came back from San Sebastian. One card came from her from there. It had a picture of the Concha and said, "Darling, very quiet and healthy, love to all the chaps, Brett." Nor did I see Robert Cohn again. I heard Francis had left for England, and I had a note from Cohn saying he was going out in the country for a couple of weeks he did not know where, but that he wanted to hold me to the fishing trip in Spain we had talked about last winter. I could reach him always, he wrote, through his bankers. Brett was gone. I was not bothered by Cohn's troubles. I rather enjoyed not having to play tennis. There was plenty of work to do. I went often to the races, dined with friends, and put in some extra time at the office getting things ahead so I could leave it in charge of my secretary when Bill Gorton and I should shove off to Spain the end of June. Bill Gorton arrived, put up a couple of days at the flat, and went off to Vienna. He was very cheerful and said the States were wonderful. New York was wonderful. There had been a grand theatrical season and a whole crop of great young light heavyweights. Any one of them was a good prospect to grow up, put on weight, and trim Dempsey. Bill was very happy. He had made a lot of money on his last book and was going to make a lot more. We had a good time while he was in Paris, and then he went off to Vienna. He was coming back in 3 weeks, and we would leave for Spain to get in some fishing and go to the fiesta at Pamplona. He wrote that Vienna was wonderful, then a card from Budapest. "Jake, Budapest is wonderful." Then I got a wire. "Back on Monday." Monday evening, he turned up at the flat. I heard his taxi stop and went to the window and called to him. He waved and started upstairs carrying his bags. I met him on the stairs and took one of the bags. "Well," I said, "I hear you had a wonderful trip."
"Wonderful," he said. "Budapest is absolutely wonderful."
"How about Vienna?"
"Not so good, Jake, not so good. It seemed better than it was."
"How do you mean?" I was getting glasses and a siphon.
"Tight, Jake. I was tight."
"That's strange. Better have a drink."
Bill rubbed his forehead.
"Remarkable thing," he said. "Don't know how it happened. Suddenly it happened."
"Last long?"
"4 days, Jake. Lasted just 4 days."
"Where did you go?"
"Don't remember. Wrote you a postcard. Remember that perfectly."
"Do anything else?"
"Not so sure. Possible."
"Go on, tell me about it."
"Can't remember, tell you anything I could remember."
"Go on, take that drink and remember."
"Might remember a little," Bill said. "Remember something about a prize fight. Enormous, Vienna prize fight. Had a nigger in it. Remember the nigger perfectly."
"Go on."
"Wonderful nigger. Looked like tiger flowers, only 4 times as big. All of a sudden everybody started to throw things. Not me. Nigger just knocked local boy down. Nigger put up his glove, wanted to make a speech. Awful noble-looking nigger. Started to make a speech. Then local white boy hit him. Then he knocked white boy cold. Then everybody commenced to throw chairs. Nigger went home with us in our car. Couldn't get his clothes. Wore my coat. Remember the whole thing now? Big sporting evening."
"What happened?"
"Loaned the nigger some clothes and went around with him to try to get his money. Claim nigger owed them money on account of wrecking hall.
Wonder who translated. Was it me?"
"Probably it wasn't you." "You're right, it wasn't me at all. Was another fellow. Think we called him the local Harvard man. Remember him now, studying music."
"How'd you come out?"
"Not so good, Jake. Injustice everywhere. Promoter claimed nigger, promised let local boy stay. Claimed nigger, violated contract, can't knock out Vienna boy in Vienna. My God, Mr. Gorton, said nigger, I didn't do nothing in there for 40 minutes but try and let him stay. That white boy must have ruptured himself swinging at me. I never did hit him."
"Did you get any money?"
"No money, Jake. All we could get was nigger's clothes. Somebody took his watch, too. Splendid nigger. Big mistake to have come to Vienna. Not so good, Jake. Not so good."
"What became of the nigger?"
Went back to Cologne. Lives there. Married. Got a family. Going to write me a letter and send me the money I loaned him. He's wonderful. Nigger. Hope I gave him the right address. You probably did.
Well, anyway, let's